Okay. Periodically, I don't have audio. Andy, my guess is you ran into Manhattan today to get the material you needed. Had to run all the way back out again. I'm going to look at the news right now, but I think they're only predicting a couple of inches. I don't think it's going to be really significant tomorrow. Thank you, Andy, for any of the comments.
Okay, hold on. I think Dick may be experiencing a technical problem. This is K2KEY. All right, very good. I'll take it for a minute or so here and give Dick a chance to get his problem straightened out there. Maybe he's also got a problem with the mic. And there was a station that just wanted to make a comment. I believe it's I couldn't catch your whole call.
Node number 4478. Active.
I'd say about at least 6-7 dB low, so if you can bring it up a little bit, I'm sure we'll be able to understand what you say. This is K2KEY. This is the TechNet. Go ahead, please.
KC2FTN.
KC2FTN. I guess it's Foxtrot Tango November, I believe. Give us your name and what would you like to discuss over?
Kilo Charlie 2, Sierra Papa November. The name is Carmine. The QTH is actually out in Copenhagen, and I must sincerely apologize for the interruption, gentlemen. I really had no idea this is a net that was in use, so I will stand down for the duration, and again, I do apologize for the intrusion. KC2SPN standing down.
Yeah, you sound WS Glenn for a comment. Hey, you sound good, and I forgot to turn on my tone. Go ahead, Paul, and do you want to give us a space report? It's up to you, Paul.
I really didn't have that much. A couple of good shows. We have the History Channel Universe every Tuesday night. For months now, they've been running a very good show. Last week they talked about the Horizon spacecraft and quite a bit, and all the different moons, regular moons, and regular moons. Good topic. Every week it's another topic. Every Tuesday night. The cold story, Dick, I think there's a part two to that. I was hoping there was a part two. It's still part one. I think there was a part two. I'll bet I didn't miss that on the Channel 13 CBS show. I did want to make a comment that not related to the space topic. We talked about the Hall effect. I looked into that a little bit. Turns out the biggest use for these things, they do mention automobiles, happens to be the keyboards that we all use on our computers. Well, the keys apparently will affect buttons that we're pushing to eliminate the contact from the keyboard. Just want to get give you an update on that. That was a long story about I'd say used up probably an hour on two different nets for the Hall effect topic with the car and how that worked. Just to give you an update on that. Been around, a guy named Hall came up with it in the 1800s. There was some piece of gold that he put down and he put a voltage through it. Wait a minute, are we still in the net mode here, Dick?
Right now, I think we're in the mode where you've got to worry about the timer every 2 minutes. Paul, go ahead. Wait for the beep.
Okay, I was afraid of that. Okay, very good. And this guy used a flat piece of gold, ran a voltage through it. He was able to detect a voltage, like a cross from this piece of gold. And that was the first time it was figured out by Hall. But not really useful until they come up with semiconductors, put a magnet in front of her, and he called the Hall effect. Now to use semiconductors, and again, you're going to get a voltage reading. I only had one question. I don't know if you look into it, Dick. You can't create voltage out of something, so my guess is that there's a voltage going across this, well, it was originally a piece of gold and then not a semiconductor material, but if there's a voltage going across something, and you put a magnet there, and just hold it there, I'm not getting involved with the effect of movement of a magnet. You put a magnet there, you're going to get a voltage coming off the side, and you're going to be able to read that, small as it might be, but with transistors and everything, what have you. This voltage has to be coming from somewhere, so my guess is the voltage is probably being reduced somewhat in the run of the circuit to create something coming off the side with magnets. That's my only curiosity about that right now. But in all the keyboards, each one is a Hall effect transistor type deal for semiconductor. Back to you, Dick. WS.
I'm having a little trouble with that one, Paul. Without a doubt, many keyboards have a device. When you press a key, you're changing the local inductance of a coil that's built under that particular key. And so it senses the presence of the metallic object connected to that key. When you press on it, changes the inductance, and therefore you say, aha, that key is being... The computer says, okay, that key is being pressed. You're implying that they're building a Hall effect device, which is a little bit on the expensive side, under each individual key. You probably have about 80 keys on that keyboard. I'm having trouble with that one. I'm going to pass it back to you for confirmation in a minute. However, a Hall effect device doesn't have true gain. From what you put into it in magnetic, you could say it's a magnetic to voltage converter. The magnetic field creates the Hall effect voltage, and you sense that. But you're supplying a lot of current to do it. By the same effect, by the same token, by the way, a transistor, from the input-output characteristics, you say it has gain. From another point of view, it does not have gain. Let me drop for a second and explain that. You're supplying an amount of VCC voltage, voltage from source to drain or from emitter to collector, and you're supplying that current. And what the transistor does is takes the voltage you apply to the gate or base, whichever is the input, depending on whether it's a FET device or a bipolar transistor, and it makes the output have the same waveform as your modeling voltage that you're putting on the gate or base. So it makes the output waveform identical to the small input waveform. Waveform-wise, input to output, it has gain. But you're supplying the power, and the electrons that go in and the electrons that come out are not the same. The output signal by way of the power supply between the source and drain, we'll say, or cathode and plate if it was a tool, it has replicated the waveform of what you put on the grid if it was a tube. But it isn't the same electron, so to speak. Well, by the same token, Hall effect device, you could say, doesn't have gain. There is a device, though, that will give you something for nothing, so to speak. A Peltier device is the one where you pour current into it, and the plate on one side gets cold, the plate on the other side gets hot. And the Peltier device is reversible. You put a source of heat on one side and a heat sink on the other side, and it will generate voltage for you. That's how the thermoelectric nuclear sources work. It's a whole bunch of Peltier devices on that hot source, in between the hot source and the heat sink. So you put a temperature difference across the Peltier device, and it is a kind of it's not a photovoltaic, it is a thermovoltaic. It converts a thermal difference, a heat difference, into voltage. Back to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, and TechNet.
Okay, very good. Yeah, we wanted to take a handful of these thermocouples that we use for gas stoves, put them in parallel and put another bunch in series, put it into a fire or something, and get a voltage out of it. That would be good. But they weren't so expensive, I would do it. The keyboard thing, I read it on the internet, so we'll have to have to look at it again. A couple of, so they lead me to believe that every button that you're pushing, you know, you got to be here. They said billions of these things that would produce the Hall effect when you get keyboards on your computer. I was tempted to take one apart, but I don't mind it broken here. The only ones I've ever taken apart were maybe an old Radio Shack TS-80. I remember taking the keys off of that. And they were contact to contact. Then the membrane keyboards of all kinds, of course, that's different. Calculator type, I've taken them apart. The keys on remote control for TV, I've taken them apart. And they're definitely not Hall effect. They claim cell phones and keyboards. I'll have to look into it. So I can't confirm that. Just something I read. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that would be fun to look into. My son just recently threw out a keyboard and had failed. Now I wish I had held onto it so I could take it apart and look inside. Most of the keyboards I've ever looked at, I thought I threw a little coil under each key. And I thought of sensing a change in inductance with 100 kc or 1 megacycle signal going through it, I'm guessing. But maybe Mel knows about that. And maybe he's got some more letters that we should be reading in email. K2KEY.
Says, what about the absolute zero story? Is there a part two to that show?
I think there's going to be a part two, three, and four. I think it's a whole series by the way they're talking about the future of getting down to absolute zero. The first show talks about the history of where for 300 years they thought cold was a substance. And, let me think now. What's the name of the device that they use now for measuring heat output of an experiment? Why can't I think of the name of that?
Calorimeter?
Calorimeter. Okay. And they used to think that the substance was called calora or something like that?
Yes.
They used to think there was a substance that created cold. Until one of the smart guys took a barrel of water out in the backyard with the trees and weighed it before and afterward, and there was no change in weight. So then they thought that this cold substance, whatever it is, was a massless substance. And the story got more and more complicated. It reminds me of the Ptolemaic system of explaining the solar system until we came up with the Copernican system, which was a hell of a lot simpler. Another example of simplest answer is usually the right one. So I'm convinced that the whole series, even though they didn't make it super clear, the way they're talking about future ones are going to be getting down to absolute zero, or close as they can get, you know, within a millikelvin of absolute zero. So it's a good show, and I'm convinced that the whole series of, I wonder if you had a chance to see that PBS show on Cold Noble that Thursday night, then they'll K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger, I sure did. And that's going to be continued. Now there'll be the next part, I guess part two, will be the quest for absolute zero. That's supposedly they had the coming attraction where they were discussing that, what happens as you approach absolute zero, and they're going to explain about the different effects on magnetism, where the future lies on it. So that should be quite an interesting program. I assume that they'll run it this week, Dick. So keep an eye out for that. And it's been a lot of things that have been going on lately, you know, and with advances in electronics, and now it seems like the quest for the superconducting magnets and all seems to be the next frontier or something, I guess, in absolute zero. The only keyboards I ever took apart also, I saw, like you say, a little coil. Some of them had that material, that rubberized material, you know, with the graphite coating on it, like they used in the hand units, but I've never seen anything exotic in a couple of the old keyboards that I broke apart, Dick, over.
Yeah, that confirms what I see. So we're going to have to dig a little deeper to see if what Paul read is accurate. the Hall effect device is sufficiently expensive. I'm having trouble, and a little bit hard to run. I mean, are they going to have all of the current of all of those Hall effect devices on all of those keys simultaneously? And you're going to have little bitty magnets on each key plastic block that you're pushing that's spring-loaded, and you bring the magnet close to the Hall effect device, and it sees these millivolts of voltage, all of those detectors, all of those Hall effect devices, all of those magnets. Sounds too expensive to me. I'm having trouble believing that our typical computer keyboard works that way. But we'll find out. Maybe you want to go to another piece of your email mail. It's up to you. HLRAW.
Okay. Now I'm just reading over this again, laughing about looking at the original price. I have a surplus at a price of like 807. They were after World War II, 1946, 7, and all that area of those days. 807 was 65 cents. 866 were $1.25. God. If you see the prices now. Or, let's see, what I just looked, well, I want to give you one more, Dick. I want you to really laugh. How much do you think that the 4X250s are now, over?
4CX250B today, I can remember when they were $25 a piece. On the surplus market, $5 a piece. And I got a pile of them at $5 a piece. I'll be amazed if you can buy one brand new today, 4CX250R, for anything less than $350. Go ahead.
How they go for prices from 110 to 190 a piece now. Oh, God. I got a bunch of them, too, I think. It was so common. It was so, like you say, for $4 or $5 a piece. I used to see them at half that, half mention. Or even less than that. Okay, very good. Very interesting, this catalog on Radio Day. Anybody interested in looking up old goodies from the good old days? I just love the covering with the young man sitting there with his sweater on and dog in the back, and they're listening to a radio with the big old trumpet speaker. I'm just keeping that up. Let's just look at these things. All right, let's see. Somebody here. Let's see. Hold on. I'll take a look.
Here we go. By the way, last week I went to the play in New York City at a place called the Music Box, and the name of the play is The Farnsworth Experiment. And a rather well-done play, very well-researched, talking about Philo T. Farnsworth, the man who invented television, the way he was treated by David Sarnoff of RCA, and the way David Sarnoff... I treated Mr. Armstrong, the inventor of FM radio. Quite a story. Very complicated story. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, there's somebody else in there, Dick. I'm on the website for Anti Electronic Supply. It says out of stock. It's a bad
about what happened during the development of television. Let me give you two sentences on it. Philo T. Farnsworth as a 16-year-old kid explains the method of breaking down the picture with horizontal scan lines. He explains it to his science/chemistry teacher in high school in Utah, where he's living, when he was 16 years of age. Unfortunately, when they interviewed that high school teacher, the very savvy lawyers that were being used by RCA Corporation were so skilled at flustering that teacher that they convinced him he wasn't sure as to the address where he lived at the time. Therefore, they discounted his story about Mr. Farnsworth explaining television to him in those days. And so another thing that happened is that when Farnsworth is developing the television tube, David Zonoff of RCA was smart enough to send Dworkin, his chief scientist, Vladimir Dworkin, over to visit Farnsworth. Farnsworth, being a very naive, straight-out, a straight-arrow guy, explained everything about what he's doing and gave away the secret, you could say. And David Zonoff explained that, saying, I didn't keep it a secret that I'm sending my man to talk to you, and you described it to him. So it wasn't clear. Poor old Farnsworth never got a dime for it, even though he invented something that was very significant, as I see it. Back to you for any other comments, Bob.
Yeah, I know the story pretty well. The oldest trick in the book, try and trip up the witness to the old crystal. Anyway, thanks a lot for that. That was just a quick question. Doesn't agree twice. No. I feel like catch that. Cool. By the way, did my audio come up?
Not enough. Every so often you talk loud and then you talk soft, and during the soft period your audio is almost not there. So you're not talking close enough to the mic, or the gain is not set high enough. But it's good clean audio when it's there. Okay, do you have any other emails that we should be addressing now? It's your choice. K2KEY, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Okay, well, I'll pick up a couple there. It's getting late, so let's just scan over a few of them. Now you talked so many times about that loop antenna that was receiving. I made up a single loop antenna exactly the way it showed. You said you used a antenna, ARRL antenna manual, where it's described for 160. Oh yeah, you know, we saw it there with the person that, wrote the article, had his wife standing in a backyard, and as I said, I remodeled it for 75 to 80 meters. The problem is, I need it's a little low. You said you added a type of Q multiplier. How do you go about doing this? Well, alright, I don't know. Should I bother saying anything about this, or give it to him on email, Dick, over?
It's a darn good question. First of all, Mel, everything I know about antennas tells me that in the case of an electrically small antenna, the real magic comes from resonance. The effective capture area of an infinitesimal antenna, whether it be loop dipole or whatever, as long as you hit resonance, it develops the full effective capture area. And, of course, you want to make it out of low enough resistance material so that when you do resonate it, it's not one just great big loading resistor, that it really is a LC resonator. So I know the Q multiplier makes an improvement, but I am guessing that your biggest leap ahead in performance is when you hit resonance of that loop. That's my guess. Correct me if I'm wrong on that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
No doubt you're right, because when you turn that loop, you keep the station up first with the direction and get the angle, and then you, of course, you manipulate that variable condenser that's across it. That's why it's got a nice wide range. Why I suggested using one from an old broadcast radio, where it goes from a few picos up to about 360, and so I think they were rated as they work excellent. But if you want to add a little, just for experiment, maybe you want to listen to some watt of a weak signal, all I did is in the previous handbooks, they had a simple FET preamp, right? Basically, I mean, I think they once described one. Basically, all you do is I added a HET. I had a number of these HEP-802s that are FET. And I just added putting the loop between the between the drain and the gate, and then I put a choke how did I do that? I can't remember. It's so late, you know. I can't remember now. It was a simple circuit using a 9-volt battery, basically. To the source. I had a little choke, in about a 2.5 millihenry choke. Yes, now I remember, to a 0.01 coupling capacitor coming off the source. Yes, with 9 volts going with the there to ground battery. I used a 9-volt, just a 9-volt regular transistor radio battery. That's the simplest little type of Q multiplier that it come up with just to experiment with. And it works quite well, Dick. Over.
Now, I'm going to make some guesses here, Mel, that you built a kind of a preamplifier that uses the coil of the antenna itself as a resonator from the drain back to the source or the drain back to the gate. I am guessing your whole so-called preamplifier is a regenerative circuit. Depending on how you adjust it, you are capable of making the whole thing break into oscillation. And if you back off a little bit from oscillation, you now have regenerative gain and a narrow banding. But the advantage of what I think you've done is that whatever insertion loss you had from resistance of your coil when it's resonated, whether it be the resistance equivalent of your variable capacitor or the resistance equivalent of the coil itself, because you've added a regenerative circuit and brought it up to near oscillation, you have canceled all of the effects of the resistance that's in the coil itself. So what you're calling a Q multiplier maybe is a regenerative preamplifier-like thing. And so once a person knows that he's moving in the direction of making it into an oscillator, but backing off to the point where it doesn't quite oscillate, he's now got a narrowband surface that he can tune, he's gotten rid of the lossy component of his resonator, now he has his cake and eats it too. He's got resonance and no loss. Am I close? K2KEY, K2LIW?
Give you a cigar. Yeah, that's basically what I did. Actually, I could say the feedback is control is actually part of the loop. And basically, yeah, I call it a Q multiplier because you know what this is? This is similar to a solid-state Q multiplier, recalling, you know, the principles of the old Q multiplier. As you remember, they used to stick on the input. Remember, Easton used to sell them in all the little two-tube device, a Q multiplier-type device. So I just made that basically up into a solid-state version of it, a simplified solid-state version. But if you recall the old Q multipliers that they used to have, the little control that, like you say, you'd back off just to the point where it would oscillate. And it would give you that good null and everything, Dick, over.
My goodness, Mel, you and I just found another place where we have something in common. 1956, I bought the kit from Heathkit called Heathkit AR3 Receiver. I was using it for 80-meter and 40-meter Morse code reception. But I was hearing too many signals at once. Eventually, a couple months later, I go back to Heathkit and I buy Heathkit Q Multiplier that works at 455 KC on their Heathkit AR3 receiver. When you turn the regenerative control too high, it would break into oscillation. But just shy of oscillation, your IF strip became high in gain, very narrow in bandwidth. You could select one CW signal at a time, peak him up, and now you would hear him very loud and everybody else very weakly if they're on a slightly different frequency, even a fraction of a kilohertz away. That was a regenerative amplifying circuit that plugged into the IF strip of the Heathkit AR3 receiver. That was the Q multiplier I used. Don't tell me you used the exact same one. Back to you, Mel.
That certainly was, you know, published in QST and CQ magazine and all. Remember, you used it to 6AK5 and was the 12AU7 or something. That circuit was around, you know, Heathkit made it up into a kit, but as you remember, that was a popular circuit in a number of the handbooks, the amateur radio handbooks, take over.
Okay, so you and I have the same Q multiplier, but because it works at 455 KC, a very popular first IF frequency, you could plug it into any receiver you wanted to, including a Collins. So maybe you didn't own a Heathkit AR3, but you plugged it into some other receiver. Out of curiosity, what receiver did you plug a Q-multiplier into, Mel?
I wasn't as wealthy as you. This is KQKEY, so I plugged it in. It was all homebrew. I didn't use the Heathkit. I made the homebrew version of it. I remember the box even that I used. I remember finding this square box that was a tin from T. They used to call it Sweet Touch Me. You know, I don't remember. It's a red can. That's what I built it into. I remember the tube sitting on top of the controls inside. Oh, God. And it was used on a surplus receiver called the ARC ARC5 receiver, Dick. Over.
I also owned an ARC5 receiver. Another place where we came in common. Nice, beautiful dial at the front end of that. And some of those ARC5 transmitters had a beautiful roller ducker built into it. That was their version those days of an antenna tuner. And that could match huge variations in antenna impedance. Very nice pieces of World War II equipment. And I bet some of those you bought down on Cortlandt Street or Canal Street in New York City. Back to you, Mel.
Of course, if you went down there, you bought an ARC5 receiver. If you wanted one that was clean, pristine shape, you know, still in its original packing, that special packing that was anti-mildew paste that they used to put in a canvas thing, you paid about $6. If you wanted one that was out of the case, you know, maybe the cabin scratched a little bit, was a $5 receiver. And, they were very nice. I bought one. Yeah, but don't work, you know, I'll bring it back, give you another one, something like that. And I remember the transmitter with the 807s also. That was put me on the air. That was the oldest stuff that I had as a hammock for a number of years back in those days. So I can say it was a lot of fun to do all those kind of things. People say don't know what we went through with some of those contraptions, over.
Yep. And some of those guys were very friendly. They had these great big wooden tables with all kinds of goodies on them. And hams and ham-like people were picking them out, picking through them. Guarantee a certain amount of theft was taking place. They were doing well enough, they almost tolerated a certain amount of it, is what I think. Canal Street, Cortlandt Street, Greenwich Street. I think all of that became the World Trade Center. Evely Electronics was one of the good guys there who moved to Hempstead or Amityville. Oh, no. He moved east. I can't remember the town. Levittown, I guess it was, that he moved to. Evely Electronics. I remember going to him and buying some 4CX250B2s after he moved. Or maybe they were for X150s. I remember he had this dumbwaiter-like thing where you would tell him what parts you want by telephone or some kind of an intercom. You would talk to the guy upstairs, who would put it on this little elevator device that brought it down to the first floor where you purchased it. I wonder if you remember that. Back to you, Mel.
If I get started on that, yeah, this is KTKY. Well, a friend of mine became the manager. We grew up together. He became the manager of a place called Rex Radio. And I'll never forget, outside the door, on the street, right on the street, put out every day, rolled his barrels out, pickle barrels, big old pickle barrels loaded with crystals, all the surplus crystals, tons of them, put it right out in the front of the door. And I'd say to him, my God, they're picking through, God knows how many are going into people's pockets, too. Who cares? He says, I got four or five more barrels of them, he says, in the back. He says, if I get out of it, I get a dollar a day, he says, to pay for my lunch. stick them out in front of the plate, like encourage people to take them, Dick, over.
Back in the days when you needed zillions of crystals on a particular frequency because you were building a crystal lattice filter, can you imagine having the ability to pick through those barrels to find all the crystals you were looking for? How much fun you would have had? Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, I know that was like just amazing all the time. But how much of this stuff was turned out during World War II? It's flabbergasting because it kept coming out of the warehouses. Tons. It just never stopped. Like the ARP, they held on for years. To the 50s, you still had all that surplus stuff. So I just can't imagine how much of that stuff they must have made. For World War II, how those contracts would just keep producing that stuff. It's just a mind boggling. All right, anyhow, and can talk about this all night long. Shall we go on to another one, Dick, here?
Did you ever own a SCR-584, which I think was a, if I've got the number right, was that a rig that had 2-meter capability? And go ahead and read another one if you'd like.
SCR-522.
There you go. Back to you, Mel.
I'm just going to say 522 is the star. He knows the 522 with the electric motors in it. Oh, yeah, that is my first 2-meter rig. Oh, what a piece of... You know what? In fact, I threw one out only within the last couple of years. That piece of machinery, that was some hunk. That was a tank unit. That's exactly what it was made for, a tank. And the power supply and everything, and the way it was put together, was made to withstand, I don't know, 50 caliber machine gun bullets flying at it. All right, let's see. Let me see if we can find something. There's limited time we have left. Hold on a minute.
KB2, YW Mobile.
You want to pick up the mobile station, Dick?
KB2YW, start off with your name and your question or comment, sir.
Slight correction, it's Kilo Bravo 2, Yankee Echo Whiskey. Name here is Guy. Location is Brooklyn, on my way to work. And I just wanted to jump in and say thanks for remembering the old times there. You guys are bringing back a lot of memories. Yep. Back to you.
I think you're saying KB2YEW, Yankee Echo Whiskey. Young, eager, and willing. You may or may not know that one of the very substantial people of this repeater group was K2YEW, who became a silent key a couple of weeks ago. Or was it a week ago? And Norm was his name. And, yeah, antique radios are a fun thing to talk about for us old-timers. People, you know, way over the hill, beyond 30 years of age. Can you remember back in the days when you were 20 and you looked at somebody who was 30 and you thought, boy, they're old? Or when you're 16 and you look at somebody who's 30? And I've told Mel a couple of times, when I was fixing television in Middle Island, Long Island, I was the only television repair person in the town, and I would visit some of the homes where people were 50, 52, 55 years of age, and they would tell me their life is older, they're old, that life is over, that they're old, all they've got left is to watch the soap operas on television and please fix their television. Times have changed. I'll back to you, Mel, with an extra email.
Yeah, good old days. I think they were good. I don't know. They said good old days. I don't know if they were so good. I'll tell you the truth, Dick. I have mixed feelings about them. I don't know if I'd like to go back and redo them again. It was so much of a struggle, at least on my end here. Let's see. I had the question. A halo, I picked up, two halo antennas. How do you like that? One for, I believe it's 6 meters, and one supposedly was for 2 meters, that this guy used on a mobile. Are they good to use today for use on any of the 2-meter repeaters? Would a halo antenna be a good mobile antenna? That's a good question, Dick. Over.
I think the answer is almost no. Any normal use of a halo antenna, it is purely horizontally polarized. And every self-respecting repeater I know of is purely vertically polarized. That doesn't put you off the air, but it puts you 10 or 15 decibels at a disadvantage when you're cross-polarized. And if you try to take a halo antenna and do something to mechanically tilt it so that it is vertically polarized, now it becomes directional. I mean, you could make it vertically polarized by tilting the plane 90 degrees and making the plane of the loop parallel to the main axis of the car. And now, forward and after the car, you will be vertically polarized. But off the side, to the left and the right, you'll have a null in the pattern. So, halos and square loops and hula hoop and, what's the other word to use? Clover leaf antennas. Beautiful antennas for horizontal polarization, mobile use, or single sideband down at 144.200 or 50.125 for sideband service. Beautiful antenna, mobile. For FM mobile repeater work, the answer is almost no. It isn't going to explode on you, but it's not going to have great performance because of that disadvantage. Now back to you, Mel.
I remember them well. The Halo, the Guelo, the Ike Beater. I think, if I'm not mistaken, the Halo and all those, I think the Halo especially was basically, what, a halfway loop, I think, bent into a circle rather than a square. Am I correct? Is that the configuration? I remember they were very popular on, especially on 6 meters, Dick, over.
Sort of a yes and a no to that, Mel. Electronically, it is a half-wave resonant antenna. Mechanically, it is much shorter than half-wave. If you truly made a half-wave dipole curved into a circle, it would have a very directional pattern. It would favor forward and aft, and it would have kind of a null off the side. If you make a loop antenna considerably smaller in circumference than a half-wave, but re-resonated, now it becomes an omnidirectional horizontal polarized antenna. That's the good news. The bad news, it becomes a little bit narrowband. If, for instance, you had a 6 meter halo and you tuned it to your favorite frequency, 50.125, by the time you got up to 50.3, the standing wave ratio would be pretty high if you didn't retune it. So it's a rather narrowband high Q antenna, but for the frequency you tune it to, it's about the best amount of performance you're going to get on a mobile for horizontal polarization without doing something real elaborate like putting a Yagi on the car. And I have done that. But people look at you like you're really crazy when you do it. KQKY, KQLIW.
Said you put a Yagi on the car. What did you do? Have to turn the car around? What happened? So you were traveling in the direction where the Yagi was not facing correctly. Did you change your destination? Take over.
Picture a speedometer cable coming off of what looks like a shift lever mounted between the two seats of the automobile. The speedometer cable goes up to the antenna and rotates it in azimuth. So now you can steer the Yagi as you're driving down the highway. You have to make sure the Yagi is immediately running straight forward and aft when you go through a toll booth. Otherwise, you'll hit somebody in the eye with it. Back to you, Mel.
Wait a minute. I've got to get this straight. You say you rotate it. I understand the cable. What are you telling me that the pipe that held the axe sent right through the roof of the car? Is that correct? Over.
I know a couple of very enthusiastic guys who did that. No. My Yagi was mounted on a mag mount on the top of the car. The speedometer cable was used in the push-pull mode, and by moving the shift lever mounted between the two seats of the station wagon, the speedometer cable went up to the mag mount on top of the roof of the car, and by pushing and pulling on the wheel with a spring return mechanism mounted at the bottom of the mast had a bearing which would allow it to rotate on the roof of above the roof of the car. So the Yagi was mounted a very small distance above the roof of the car, and you could locate it in azimuth. Now back to you, Mel.
Okay. Sounds like quite a contraption. Okay, yes, I've seen a few of those, set up with the antenna rod coming right through, and yeah, I just couldn't picture myself riding along with such a thing. All right, let's see. The time left. What do we got? Anything that I can understand? I picked up a gadget. This says it is a Loran C frequency calibrator. What exactly is a Loran C frequency calibrator? I don't know. What was a Loran C frequency calibrator, Dick? Maybe you know what it is, over.
Okay, I'm not sure if Loran C is still in existence. I've been threatening to remove it for a long time. You have along the coast of the United States and a whole lot of places specific transmitters that put out a signal of around 1.8 megacycles, and the signal they put out is very precise in frequency and phase, and so by using a fancy receiver that looks at the phase difference of two stations, in other words, you're floating your boat out in the Atlantic Ocean, we'll say you're 5 miles offshore, and you look at two separate Loran C stations, and you look at the phase difference of the signal you get between the two, that allows you to locate yourself along these two parabolic arcs as to where your ship is located. It was a significant navigating system, which can be used over land, but it gives you much less accuracy over land because I said 1.8 megacycles. Maybe it's 100 kc. Beginning to think Loran C is 100 kc. I'm confused now as to whether it's 100 kc or 1.8 meg. There are two separate navigating systems. We'll eventually straighten that one out. But in either case, you're looking at the phase difference between two or three stations in order to locate yourself. It gives you rather good locating. I'm going to guess to the nearest 50 meters or so over water, but the accuracy over land is nowhere near as good. For a couple of reasons. You can't be too far inland because the stations are always on the coast. And second of all, those low-frequency signals propagate at a different rate over land than they do over water, and that creates an error. Somewhat deterministic, you can crank some of the error back out, but it is a navigating, locating system. We just have to figure out what frequency it's on. And so a frequency calibrator, I guess, would be making sure that when you tune to these individual stations, that your receiver has the required accuracy. I've never seen one, but I'm making a guess. Back to you, Mel.
Just wanted to comment, whoever asked the question, LORAN stands for Long Range Navigation.
Okay, if you happen to know what frequency we're on, it's either 100 kc or 1.8 meg, and there's a Loran C, and I guess there used to be a Loran A and a B. So I've got this beautiful book that describes Loran C. You have to know what frequency they were on, Rich.
100 kc, Dick.
Yeah, I think the one on 160 meters they shut down was Loran A.
That makes some sense. Okay, so Loran C, 100 kc, and I believe they were something like quarter megawatt or half megawatt transmitters, all solid state. Quite an elaborate piece of electronics. And I think you can pretty nicely say that they are 98% superseded by global positioning satellite receiver systems. What do you think, Mel? Go ahead.
The Loran C, the 100 kc system. Now, actually, when you took a fix, supposedly, with Loran C, you were really looking, what was it? They were extremely accurate. I know that that was based on the time accuracy. So what were you really looking at to determine the receiver? Actually, what did it do? It measured, there was a critical measurement of the time, the difference in the time from one Loran C transmitter to the other. Is that way basically what it was worked by, Dick, over?
Yes. There's some very precise timing and frequency accuracy. Assuming now that you've got two stations that are, I'm going to pick a number, 200 miles apart, they're arranged in such a way that both is transmitting the exact same frequency with the exact same phase. As you get closer to one station compared to the other, you will experience a phase advance on the signal from the first station. And I'm guessing each station has a pseudo-random code which allows you to separate the two separate signals. So it's the timing of the pseudo-random code that you're picking up, very similar to a kind of pseudo-random code that exists with the global positioning satellite receiver system. So I think they're on the exact same frequency, and they each have an orthogonal code. I wonder if that sounds right. Anybody want to comment on that one?
WS2N on a different topic, on that hole topic.
All right, we'll get to the hole in a minute. Back to you, Mel, on this one.
Let's get back to the hole. Just say real quick, I think what you say is correct. I believe that each pulse was very short, like a 250 microsecond or something duration. And they emitted a certain eight. I know a I used to think, if I remember correctly, I once heard it emitted a burst of these pulses, like a series, I think, of eight at one time or something. I'm trying to recall. All right, pick up a call. It'll come back to me, basically. I think you more or less had the right idea on the Lorentz feed with the precise timing stick over. And I think also what they call a constant ground wave, constant signal path system, if I'm not mistaken, over.
Yeah, it depended on the ground wave being constant in phase velocity. Very similar to the phase velocity we measure of a coax cable. Okay, tell us what you found out about Hall effect devices and keyboards there, Paul. You got it, Paul.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, well, one of the sites I did find it, went back to the computer, and I found this article by Edmund Ranson. He's a senior engineer for Lattice Semiconductor in Hillsborough, Oregon. And it's a long description of the Hall effect. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but then he gets to the part where he says, one of the first major applications was in computer keyboards replacing mechanical contact. Hundreds of millions of these devices are now manufactured each year. And he goes on with the other applications, including automobiles, industrial control systems, cell phones, like I mentioned before. So this type of thing is out there. It's a long website if you want to look at it, but it's URL, Dick, but I definitely got to get a hold of one of the boards, rip them apart. Maybe they made them at one time, now they're using something else. Who knows? Back to you.
Did you see George with a comment? Go ahead, I think it's Gordon.
Glenn, just a real quick thing about Hall effect devices and keyboards that I'm aware of. I don't know if them being used commercially in computers, but I certainly know that in certain industrial and military applications, and definitely in aviation, Honeywell Corporation, in some of the, I think Boeing was using it for a while, the keypads and instrumentation, in order to add extra very high reliability to the key button keystroke switches, use Hall effect devices in those applications, or also in areas where there's, use any kind of area where there has to be very, very high reliability.
Yeah, that I can accept, because anything with a quick switch closure is going to develop eventually oxidation of the switch contacts, wear, switch bounce, and therefore you think you close the switch once, the electronics think you close it three times in a row when you get a different response, semi-second. So when it comes to high reliability, bounce-free switching, I can see how magnetic sensing, inductive sensing, and Hall effect sensing would be the great way to go. But a little bit more expensive. And it's the extra expense that tells me, without a doubt, the Department of Defense is going to be using it on their hardware, and certain high-end automobiles are going to be using it on their front panel switches. But are you going to use it on the 80 keys or whatever it is of a keyboard, 60 keys of a computer? That's left to be discovered. You got it, Mel.
Hey, Dick.
Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, you know, on cars in the 70s, I think Chrysler did this before they did away with the distributor altogether and they were going to electronic distributors. They used a Hall effect device in the distributor to simulate the point.
And I think Nissan or some of the other automobiles used one of those. My son had an automobile that eventually developed intermittency in the ignition system. And that ignition system coil cost $470 to replace. Boy, it must have had gold-plated contacts in there. You got it, Mel.
Yeah, Roger. Okay, very good. Yeah, I can recall some of those ideas that they had. Especially Chrysler was very innovative in a number of... push buttons, transmission controls, and all that stuff, so it wouldn't surprise me. All right, just got about ready to lose the repeater here, so say goodnight to everybody. The microwave and the oven just warming up a little tea for the... just a little taste of tea. So, with that, I'll say goodnight to all. Thank you very much for joining us. And we'll try to do it again next week. And I try to answer the emails as best as possible. And it's got to stay within the realm of amateur radio. I've said this a number of times, but I have to repeat it periodically. Okay, Dick, any final words from you?
And WS2N. This is from a book, by the way. The guy wrote a book, Hall Effect Sensors.
And what did he say quickly, Paul?
I'm going to run out of time. It's quicker to give you the URL. http://www.elsevier. Echo. Click there. India Echo Romeo. .com/WPapaSierra/find/bookdescription.cws-home/707310/description. Then pound sign, and again the word description, description. Anybody wants to look it up, give it a shot. I've seen this guy's book advertised a number of different sites. Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to assume also I can find him by way of a Google search. Thank you for that, Paul. Okay, check in number 1,170. 1,170 is what you guys just listened to. And you spent the last 4 hours of your life doing that. Okay, we'll be back next week. Be kind to each other. 73-year-old. Bye-bye for now. KQRIW and Mel, KQ and KEY, we're clear.